Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Wednesday, the 17th of May. Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Fintan Warfield, Sinn Féin Senator. It's time to disregard criminal records of gay men convicted of historical offences. We'll talk to Magdalene Rogers. She's Executive Director at the Neurological Alliance of Ireland. An estimated 800,000 people in Ireland are living with a neurological condition. We'll speak to Nat O'Connor, Policy Specialist at Age Action Ireland. Do people on fixed incomes struggle to afford social activities? And then we'll speak to Professor John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography. One of the next 5 years are set to be the warmest on record, according to the World Meteorological Organization. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can call in on 045 898 999. You can email on studio@kfmradio.com, or you can send a text.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, Sinn Féin are calling on the government to honour their commitment to disregard the criminal records of gay men who were convicted of historic offences prior to the decriminalisation of homosexuality. And I'm joined now on the line by Fintan Warfield. He is a Sinn Féin senator. Good afternoon, Fintan.
Hey, Caoimhe. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to have you, Fintan. For some people listening in today, Fintan, this will come as a bit of a shock that some gay men still have these offences on their records. And maybe you might talk us through that.
Yeah, so I think there's around 1,000 convictions under the old Victorian laws, which were mainly kind of offences against the Person Act from the 1860s. These stayed on the books of the state up until 1993, when homosexuality was decriminalised here in this state. So in 2018, the government issued an apology to the LGBT community on behalf of the state, and made a commitment to expunge the criminal records of gay men and bisexual men who were convicted of historical offences. It wasn't just gay men. You know, the air of criminality obviously affected many people, including women. And so, you know, we're 30 years on now from 1993. So time is of the essence. This is a commitment that government have made, and we think that they should honour.
I mean, it's shocking, really, that it was only 30 years ago. It seems like a very, you know, short space of time. It really is astonishing. What steps have been taken by government to disregard these offences?
So they made the commitment in 2018. They've set up a working group to examine the issue. That group was due to report last year. But I understand, and Simon Harris has been out today to say that the report is imminent. So what we'll be saying today is that government should be drafting this legislation as we speak, and we'll be calling for a clear timeline to be set out for the introduction of it, and a scheme as well that would disregard the convictions. Originally, the language used was to expunge, which would mean to destroy the records. And I think the working group is of the view that disregarding the records would be preferable in terms of enabling historians and researchers to research around the issue in the future. So
keep the records, but they won't stand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And okay.
I ask you then, Fintan, for the people or the men and women involved in these convictions, how does that affect them? Because I know in other facets of society, say, let's say you're convicted of a murder or something, you know, you maybe can't get a visa to go to the US or Australia. Is that the same with this conviction?
Yeah, any conviction, indeed. Wow. Yeah, like drug use or, you know, those kind of issues often present problems with employment. And travel primarily, so that would apply here as well. They're the practical issues that exist.
Okay. Have you spoken to any of the people involved in this? How do they feel about it?
Yeah, they're welcoming the motion today. There's a sense out there that the progress is a bit slow. So that's what we're hoping to do today, to light a fire under the government to get them moving, because, like I said, time is of the essence for people who are most affected by these laws. And it, you know, it's also 50 years since the first group, LGBT group, met in Trinity College this year. So for those people, they spent 20 years fighting criminalisation, and so that's been a long fight for them.
Absolutely.
So,
what can be done in the short term, Fintan, or what do you think should be done?
Well, we think the legislation shouldn't take too long. You know, if it's drafted, it can be introduced in before Christmas. We think so. That should be the priority in our view.
Okay, Fintan Warfield, Sinn Féin Senator. Thanks very much, Fintan, for joining us with that news there, that Sinn Féin is calling for the criminal records of gay men convicted of historical offences to be disregarded. And I'd love to know what you think about this. 0833 97 97 97. I was born in 93, so 30 years ago. And it's kind of shocking that people actually would be convicted of an offence at that time if they were gay. So maybe you know someone, maybe you were convicted. We'd love to hear from you. 0833 97 97 97. Now, if anyone has a whopping 20.5 million hanging around, the Brennan brothers are getting out of the five-star hotel business. So the stars of At Your Service have put the Park Hotel in Kenmare up for sale, saying it's time to pursue other interests. John and Frances Brennan had run the acclaimed hotel for 37 years. The Park and its sister hotel, the Lansdowne Kenmare, are on the market for a joint guide price, like I said, 20.5 million euro. So maybe if you win the lotto tonight or over the weekend, you might want to get into the hotel business. But there you go now, selling up. You wouldn't have thought that they'd throw in the towel. It seems like that's their baby, but you never know what they're going to do now. Now, I'm seeing something here. Denise Welch, of course, she's a star of Loose Women. She was also a Natalie Barnes in Coronation Street, for anyone who watches that. And she was in Hollyoaks as well. But she says that she's been talking about her depression, which can make her look like she's awake, but she says it leaves her unresponsive to anything around her. So the Loose Women star has been warning people about the signs to look out for when someone is struggling with depression. And the actress, who has also been known for her soap roles, says she's been living with the condition for more than 30 years, should I say. So there you go now. She says the signs to look out for can be that a person seems awake, but they're unresponsive to anything around them. So something to keep in mind there, just in case. And Gossip Girl fans, because I am a Gossip Girl fan, many people out there will have watched it. Of course, Blake Lively in it, who's married to Ryan Reynolds. She was the star of the show. Well, Gossip Girl fans are in a frenzy today because there's a possible reboot up for a decision, maybe, and the original cast could be in it as well. The show tweeted saying, "Welcome back, Upper East Siders," along with a photo of the hit 2007 cast featuring Blake Lively and Leighton Meester. The award-winning series ran for 6 seasons between 2007 and 2013 and was based around the lives of the privileged upper-class teens in Manhattan. So in 2021, HBO Max launched a revival series with a brand new cast of actors, which has since been cancelled after 2 seasons. Yeah, and I'm not surprised that it's been cancelled, because it wasn't good. No offence to them, but I find the remakes are never the same. Like, you just can't remake something that's good. You know, it's already been done, and when they try and do it again, it's just not the same. Let me know what you think. 0833 97 97 97. Now, someone has texted in here. Of course, we had Fintan Warfield on about the he's a Sinn Féin senator, and Sinn Féin are calling for the disregard of criminal records of gay men convicted of historical abuse. And this person has texted in saying, "Hi, the law of the land was the law back then. There is no way that their convictions should be dropped. They broke the law at the time." Okay, I can't say I'm in agreement with that listener, but everyone is entitled to their opinion. 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, an estimated 800,000 people in Ireland are living with a neurological condition. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Magdalene Rogers. She's Executive Director at Neurological Alliance of Ireland. Good afternoon, Magdalene.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe, and thanks for this opportunity to talk to your listeners this afternoon.
Delighted to have you on, Magdalene. Before we get down to business, can you tell me a little bit about a neurological condition and what kind of condition that is or what it entails?
Yes, indeed, Caoimhe. Well, it's a staggering figure that 800,000 people in Ireland are living with a neurological condition. But it's important to stress that that covers everything from migraine, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease. Basically, neurological conditions affect the brain and spinal cord. And I think if we pause, we all know someone in our immediate circle, a family member, a friend, who's living with one of these conditions.
Absolutely. You have a new report out that's putting a spotlight on community services available nationwide for people with neurological conditions. Can you talk us through that?
So we presented to the Oireachtas Committee on Health just this morning, Caoimhe, on this issue of access to community neurorehabilitation teams. So these are multidisciplinary therapy teams in the community. They provide therapies like speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, psychology to people living with neurological conditions. And it's important to stress they provide specialist services. So these are dedicated therapists. They specialise in neurological conditions. They talk to each other. They plan the person's care. And these can often be quite complex needs for people with acquired brain injury or stroke or people living with multiple conditions like multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's disease. And because those teams aren't available all across the country, what we're seeing are people that, they're unnecessary disability with neurological conditions because they can't access that specialist therapy they need. And what we were saying to the Oireachtas Health Committee, what we now have is a postcode lottery where people in some parts of Ireland can access a community neurorehabilitation team and others can't.
Absolutely. And as I understand, there's 60 community-based voluntary organisations, but because there's no statutory service, it's not really, required in each county. And like you said there, you know, maybe if you're living in Dublin, you might have better access than someone living in Longford.
What we pointed out was that you would think that, Caoimhe, but actually the teams that are in place, community neurorehabilitation teams that are in place, are based in CHOs 1 and 3. So that's in Donegal and Limerick. So we're seeing a situation where people in the east of the country are disenfranchised when it comes to access to community neurorehabilitation services. You might think it would be better for people living in the east, maybe near enough to a Dublin hospital, although I'm a Kildare woman myself and I know how far away some parts of Kildare are from the Dublin hospitals. So what we're seeing is that, as I say, people in some parts of the country can access these community teams and others don't have access. And in HCCHO Area 7, which includes Kildare, there isn't a community neurorehabilitation team. Now, the unfortunate thing is that a team was funded as far back as November 2020 and it still hasn't been established. There's been no movement on recruitment for that team, on putting that team in place. And we highlighted to the committee this morning that, again, we have this postcode lottery where people in Kildare can't access the team despite one being funded since 2020.
Okay, so that's unusual because usually, like you said there, Magdalene, in the east, we sometimes are better off than people in other parts of the country. So what is the holdup then in CHO 7 in Kildare and why haven't they made progress?
Well, we highlighted this to the Oireachtas Committee on Health and we called for action on this by the HSE that they would address whatever is holding up the situation in CHO 6 and 7. We're a long time out of COVID now. I don't think we can blame anything on COVID delays anymore, particularly as the funding was in place there since 2020. And we really need to see movement on this because we're saying to patients every day, if you lived in Limerick, if you lived in Donegal, you would have access to a community neurorehabilitation team that you don't have in counties like Kildare.
Okay, very, very interesting. I can't believe Donegal are so well equipped for this because sometimes in the more rural areas, it's not as good. So tell us about the outputs that you're looking for in the neuromapping project and how you're going to go about getting that.
So the neuromapping project is a piece of work that we're doing with the HSE and also with an umbrella body for disability organisations called the Disability Federation of Ireland. Just to stress that voluntary organisations that you mentioned at the start of the interview, they provide essential support to people with neurological conditions. That's absolutely not to take away from the really valuable work that charities do to support people with neurological conditions long term in the community. And it is is all part of a pathway. These community neurorehabilitation teams provide that intensive therapeutic support they provided for 12 weeks for someone recovering from the likes of a stroke or an acquired brain injury. But then the voluntary organisations take over at that stage and provide that critical long-term support to get people back to work, to get people back involved in their communities. And the neuromapping project is for the first time going to look in depth at what it is that those organisations do and what they provide and what the barriers are in terms of resourcing of those services. And it will look as well in areas where there are community neurorehabilitation teams, how does that improve life for people living with neurological conditions? And how can they all work together? Because it is part of the pathway. All parts of those services are needed, from the community neurorehabilitation team straight when you come out of hospital to the longer-term services provided by the voluntary organisations to get people back on their feet and to keep them well in their community.
Okay, do the statutory and voluntary providers, do they work hand-in-hand in tandem, or are they, you know, kind of, obviously they are separate, but do they work together in any way?
Well, we're aware, and one of the things we want to look at in the neuromapping project, and we did just release, as you say, we just released the phase one report, and that looked at five examples around the country of where statutory and voluntary organisations are working in partnership. They're working to provide the synergistic service where they're both providing a part of the service, and those work really well. And the phase two of the neuromapping project, which we're hoping to roll out in the coming months, is going to look at that in more detail within individual areas of the country, what that needs to continue, what's unique about those innovations, and how we can roll out better community services for people with neurological conditions. Because it really is, as I say, it's a postcode lottery, and depending on where you live, depending on the service that you can get, there should be basic services there for a person with a neurological condition, no matter where they live around the country. And that's one of the things we stressed to the Oireachtas Committee on Health this morning.
Okay, did you speak to the Oireachtas Committee about maybe a timeline for CHO7 and CHO6? And of course, that includes Kildare. Is there any update on when that might progress, Magdalene?
We understand there is a commitment to deliver the team by the end of this year. We will be very closely watching that commitment, given the delay that there has been so far. We're not very reassured by the fact that the funding is available in 2020 and recruitment hasn't even started for the team in CHO7. So we will be watching it extremely closely. I would just like to say to your listeners, we do have a dedicated website, patientsdeservebetter.ie. If people go onto that website, they can contact their elected representatives directly in Kildare and highlight the need for a community neurorehabilitation team in the area.
Okay, Magdalene Rogers, Executive Director at Neurological Alliance of Ireland. Thanks very much, Magdalene, for joining us. Now, Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has announced a new scheme that will allow over 65s to go to the cinema every Tuesday for just €2, 2 weeks before the country heads into the polls for a crucial regional and municipal elections. Well, it got me thinking about the price of cinema tickets here, and I suppose this new information has also got other people thinking, and TDs within Ireland, because an independent TD for Sligo Leitrim, Marion Harkin, has also backed these calls, and she says that something like they've introduced in Spain would be brilliant here in Ireland for people over 65, and she has said subsidised tickets for cultural events could benefit older people and, of course, the arts. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Nat O'Connor. He's a policy specialist at Age Action Ireland. Good afternoon, Nat.
Good afternoon.
Nat, what do you think of this news in Spain?
Well, I think the main idea here is very good, which is that, you know, older people should be encouraged to get out and about, to socialise, to get involved in all sorts of activities, cultural activities and so on. And that there, you know, there are lots of free of charge activities as well as things like the cinema or theatre and so on. But what they've recognised in Spain is that cost is often a barrier to participation. Now, in this case, what they're looking at is subsidising cinema tickets. You know, I'd argue that that's probably too specific. Not everybody wants to go to the cinema, or they mightn't have a cinema in their area. But I think the issue of cost is something we have to look at. And, you know, when Deputy Harkin spoke about this issue, she recognised that income is a real barrier to people, that, you know, we're all feeling the stress of the cost of living crisis. The state pension has a much lower spending power now. It's worth €18 a week less in what you can buy compared to 2020 in terms of its spending power. So the amount of the pension has gone up, but what you can actually get for it has gone down. So looking at the cost barriers makes an awful lot of sense.
Absolutely. I suppose, you're probably right there, Nat, that not everyone would have a cinema in their locality. But if you just, let's say the people do, cinemas are quite expensive to go to. Like, I think the last time I was at the cinema, it was maybe €10 for a ticket or €10.50 just for the ticket. And then, of course, you know, if you want to get some refreshments or something like that, you can really see the money add up. And it's not very affordable to go to.
Well, this is it. And when you've hit the nail on the head in the sense that, you know, these kinds of events, it's not just about getting a ticket, but if you want to have a cup of tea or, you know, if you need to pay for transport, maybe to get a local bus or whatever it might be, it all adds up. And so there's a cost to, you know, social inclusion, to being included. And it might just add up to €20 or €30, but that's an awful lot of money if you're on the state pension. And so what we've seen in our research at Age Action is that, you know, that transport is a huge barrier to people. A lot of people, if they're not driving themselves or they can no longer drive, you know, they rely on others for a lift, and they're very reluctant to ask for a lift for something that they might regard as frivolous.
You know,
such as going to the cinema. Whereas, you know, we'd encourage people to say, look, you know, you're entitled to get out and about. You know, it's not healthy for people to not be socially included, to not get active in terms of these activities. So it is important to get out and about, but at the end of the day, it recognises that there's a cost involved.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that it's about making sure that the state pension income is good enough that people can be fully socially included.
Yeah, I wonder, is the answer not maybe, you know, to have subsidised events, not even just the cinema, but, you know, maybe meals, you know, concerts, that kind of thing. Because even just the cinema, or like even take it, go to a match in Kildare, some of the matches to pay in, you know, you might be talking €10, €15, you know, it's obviously cheaper for OAPs. But again, like if you're doing that once or twice a week, people on restricted incomes probably can't afford that.
Well, I mean, it's funny you should talk about the cheaper ticket price, because I've heard from some older people who are trying to book matches and there's no longer a cheaper price. Never mind the fact that they're being pushed to go online to buy the tickets, which not everybody can do. So, I mean, it's a commercial decision by businesses. If they offer reductions for students or for older people or whoever else, they might get business that they wouldn't otherwise get. And so certainly that's something for businesses to look at, that there's maybe an opportunity to get more footfall, you know, if they look at how the prices are affecting older people. And certainly, you know, obviously we welcome that. But at the same time, you know, there are lots of free of charge cultural events put on by local authorities and by cultural organisations. But the difficulty is that there can be associated costs, and transport is the key one, that if people can't get from their home to the event, then that's a barrier that needs to be overcome.
Is transport the main issue that you hear in Age Action Ireland?
There's so many issues at the moment. Mm. But when we did a big sort of state of ageing review last year, transport emerged as really quite a game changer. And it's particularly an issue for the issues of social inclusion, like you mentioned, like going to the cinema, going to a match. You know, many older people don't drive. You know, half of women over the age of 75 don't have a driving license.
Mm.
And many are living alone. So you have an awful lot of people who are not in the position to drive. And not everybody has children or wants to rely on children to drive them. So there is a network of neighbours, and people are very good in terms of giving a lift and helping out. But it does create, you know, a dependency on the goodwill of others, and people don't want to abuse that. And so that leads to a situation where people don't, you know.
I suppose if you're living alone, Nat, maybe, you know, you might have to go to a hospital appointment once a month, and this might be viewed as, you know, a social outing, discretionary, and they might think, well, I don't want to call in that favour now for when I might need it for something that's crucial.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So that's the concern. So, I mean, there are obviously rural bus schemes, but we'd like to see more of those. And a lot of people who have the free travel card, and people really value that, but they don't get to use it in some rural areas.
Mm.
And so, you know, if there was options to use it for rural, you know, taxis or hackneys in rural areas, you know, ways in which we could break down the barriers to allow people to get out and about and to get involved in these activities.
Okay, Nat O'Connor, Policy Specialist at Age Action Ireland. Thanks very much, Nat, for joining us. And with that news there, that in Spain, they are introducing a €2 cinema ticket every Tuesday night to help people get back into the local communities for over 65s. So they'll be able to go and spend their money there, and it'll only be €2. What do you think about that? 0833 97 97 97. Would you like to see something similar come in here? Maybe there are a free things going on in your area. And if there are, let me know to 0833 97 97 97. In the next 5 years is set to be the warmest on record. That's according to the World Meteorological Organization. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Professor John Sweeney. He's an Emeritus Professor of Geography. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Kiva.
John, it's not good news, I suppose, what's coming out today, that combined with human-induced climate change, it will have a far-reaching repercussion for health, food and security, water management and the environment. Tell us more, John.
Well, this is a report of the World Meteorological Organization, which is a very respected authority which comprises 145 of the Met offices and Met services around the world. So when they talk, I think it's incumbent on us to listen. And what they're saying today is that we're entering a period now where the masking of the warming trend in global climate by a La Nina event for the past 3 years is now coming to an end. Instead, we're entering a period where an El Nino event, i.e. the warming of the Pacific, is now confidently expected to occur over the next few months. And what they're saying is that this will probably mean that the spike that we've seen in global temperatures will actually get worse over the next 5 years. And in particular, they're saying there's about a 2-to-1 chance that we'll exceed that critical value of 1.5 degrees that we signed up to in Paris in 2015, that we would do everything in our power to avoid exceeding. Now, it's going to be an exceedance which will not last forever, and we'll probably come back down below that in a couple of years after the El Nino subsides. But what it's telling us is that kind of dangerous, if you like, threshold event is going to become a more common occurrence in the years ahead. And the El Nino that we're going to experience, the first since 2016, is probably going to mean that we'll exceed the warmest year on record. I suspect not this year, but certainly in 2024, it looks, if you were a betting person, that would be the year I would expect us to go above that 1.5 degrees. And why is that important, you say? Well, it's important because it's defined as a kind of a tipping point where some things may happen in global climate that we may not be easily able to recover from. And those kind of things are, firstly, the loss of the tropical coral reefs may well be accelerated beyond redemption. And secondly, we're beginning to see the melting out of Greenland gathering momentum. And that will take a long time, but it's not something that will be easily reversed. And why is that important for Ireland? Well, it's important because it does influence the Gulf Stream, it influences our weather types, and it influences the way in which the jet stream passes across Ireland, giving probably more in the way of extreme events for Ireland and for much of Europe in the years ahead. So it's not something that we should take sitting down. We're currently about 1.15 degrees above the pre-industrial level, and it won't take too much to get us above that 1.5. And from there, of course, we may be entering unknown territory in global climate, and we would be worried about things like the Gulf Stream failing in the longer term. We would be worried about melting out of Antarctica, parts of the Antarctic Peninsula, the Amazonian forest, which the World Meteorological Organization today are saying is going to experience drought and dryness probably over the next few years. So there's a whole host of consequences. And in the end of the day, the other thing we have to remember is, you know, you may think, well, what does it mean for us in Ireland? We're not causing this. But in fact, we are contributing 50% more per capita to this problem than the European average. We're contributing in our own small way to making matters worse. So it behoves us, I think, to take very seriously this particular warning and to get down to brass tacks in terms of taking the radical steps necessary to tackle climate change. I mean, we've kicked it into the long grass for many decades here in Ireland. We're still trying to go for a gradualistic approach to tackling climate change. But what this report is saying is that time has now run out. Okay. That, in fact, we're going to have to do things much more radically than we did in the past.
Just to come in on you there, John, because you're saying, you know, this report shows that we should be worried about the Gulf Stream failing, etc. Like, what happens if the Gulf Stream fails? Because for most people, they don't, like, that doesn't really mean anything to them.
Well, if the Gulf Stream fails, we enter into a very strange situation, because our climate would be much more like the climate of the eastern seaboard of North America, with very snowy winters, with very strange winters of extreme cold and snow. That's rather an alien thing to comprehend, given that we've been talking about global warming as causing this. But what is happening is that the melting out of places like Greenland is putting a lot of fresh water into the Atlantic, and that fresh water is disrupting the flow of the Gulf Stream and North Atlantic drift. And that's the worry, that if that gathers more momentum, we may face those kind of dislocations in climate, which we can't really fathom at the moment what it will mean for us in great detail. But it certainly won't be good news for people who are accustomed, as we are here in Ireland, to a stable winter moderate climate type. So, you know, it's rather ironic that, you know, we may be looking at problems down the road of a type we haven't encountered before. And that's why the problems of El Niño and La Niña, which are natural events, we're now compounding those events. And this is what climate change does. It multiplies the risk. It multiplies the hazard. It multiplies the unknowns for the future. So it is a report which I think our own Met Aaron was part of as well. So it's a report we have to really take seriously, because it's saying that probably in the next 5 years, we're going to hit that first threshold of 1.5 degrees. And in the years following that, we may be challenging the 2-degree one, where even worse things can happen to global climate. So the message is very clear that, you know, the time for procrastination is gone. And really, we all have to bear the pain if we want to try and ensure that some of those, if you like, bad conclusions that may occur down the road are rendered less, perhaps, damaging to us here in Ireland than they would otherwise be.
Okay, Professor John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography. Thanks very much, John, for your time. That's all we have time for today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow between 2 and 3.